My name is David Weaver Zerker. The committee that's putting together this weekend and has done such a great job of having all kinds of events asked me if I'd share a few reflections about our church's history, our congregation's history, and particularly in light of some larger themes such as Lancaster County Mennonite history, maybe some larger themes about colonial America and American history. So I'll try to make some of those connections. This afternoon you'll hear a lot more details about families and names, and I'll try to weave some of those things in as well. But if you've been paying attention this morning, you know this is the 200th anniversary of our congregation establishing a building where they worship together. That was in 1816. It was on this site. That building, you probably heard, is no longer here. It was torn down. But it was very nearby. It was out in the cemetery, and there's some people here, I'm sure Chris Zimmerman and others could tell you exactly where it sat out there in the cemetery. This is the first church that I've attended in my life. I've been here about 10 years. This is the first church I've attended that has its own cemetery, which is something that I really like. Despite the title of my talk this morning, Hill of the Living Dead, I've never seen any zombies at Wednesday Night Out. But as a person interested in history, I know that the dead still live. And they live in the decisions that they made and in the trajectories that they set. And when I drive past our cemetery every Sunday, it reminds me that the dead are still living among us. Now, who are those dead people out there? I want to take a look at a few of the graves. Here's a Hess, a Christian Hess. I'm going to talk about him in a little bit, say a little bit more about him. There are some Hertzlers and some Musselmans. And, of course, there are some Zimmermans. There are lots of Zimmermans out there, trust me. Now, last I looked, there were no Rios. There were no Salines. There were no Onalangsies. I've not seen any Schertzers out there, at least any dead ones. And I've not seen any Zerkers either. But regardless of your last name or your history with this congregation, again, I've been here only about 10 years, those people out there are us. They're our spiritual forefathers and our spiritual foremothers. And what I hope to do in the next 40 minutes or so is introduce you to a few of those people, and by doing that, provide a picture that helps us understand our congregation a little better and the life that we've lived together for more than two centuries. And more specifically, I'm going to tell you four stories about the past that show that the people who are no longer still living are, in a very real sense, still very much alive. So the first story I'm going to tell is entitled Martyr's Mere and Mennonite Migrants. Martyr's Mere is a book of martyrs, not unlike Fox's Book of Martyrs that some of you would know, only it focuses on a different set of people. The martyrs included in Martyr's Mere were Anabaptists, not anti-Baptists, okay, but Anabaptists, which literally means rebaptizers. Anabaptists were Christians who, during the Protestant Reformation, believed that you should not baptize infants, but only adults. That is, you should only baptize people who could make a decision to follow Christ on their own. The Anabaptists believed some other things, too. They believed that Christians, if they were to call themselves Christians, should do their best to live like Jesus lived, which, among other things, meant that they shouldn't take up the sword to kill others, even those who wanted to kill them. And there were a lot who did. Before long, some of these Anabaptists would take the name Mennonite, a name that derived from one of their early leaders, a former Catholic priest named Menno Simons. So there, at least, is one artist's rendering of Menno Simons, the founder of Mennonites. These Anabaptist ideas may not sound particularly dangerous today, but many people thought very differently in the 16th century. 16th century Protestants and Catholics didn't agree on very much, but they all agreed that killing Anabaptists was a pretty good idea. And that's where we get this book, Martyr's Mirror, a book that was first published in 1660 and later illustrated with a few pictures I'm going to show you. One of the pictures is with an account of a man named Henrik Pruett. And I won't say much about these martyrs other than how they died. Henrik Pruett was slathered in tar, tied to a boat, and set afire in a Dutch harbor. There's the account of a man named Wolfgang Pinder, whose executioner bungled his job so badly that according to the text beside this picture, he had to hack off Pinder's head as best he could. And there's a story of Anna of Rotterdam, who handed off her one-year-old son, whose name was Isaiah, on her way to the executioner, handed him off to a merchant in town to raise after she was gone. And maybe most famously, there's the account of Dirk Willems. Dirk took the pains to rescue his pursuer, and that's Dirk leaning down in that picture, rescue his pursuer from drowning. Dirk was rewarded for that good deed by being arrested and being burned at the stake. Dirk's story is probably the best known story in Martyr's Mirror, but I want to read another story to you this morning, a story that shows up on page 1115 in the English edition of this book. And this is how this story goes. Among those who suffered the Swiss persecution was Hans Jakob Hess. Hans was apprehended in 1639, and he was imprisoned for more than a year. In the same year, his wife was apprehended and imprisoned. Through bad treatment and bad food, she was stricken by consumption, and after much misery, she died in prison. This then was the end of this pious heroine of Jesus, who, because of her faith, chose to die in prison rather than enjoy the pleasures of life. This account from Martyr's Mirror talks about Hans Jakob Hess, but it talks about the death of his wife. Doesn't mention her name, but we know her to be Anna Egli Hess. Hans and Anna had 8 children, and in 1717, their great-grandson, also named Hans, boarded a boat to the New World, where he traveled through the port of Philadelphia, and he settled in Lancaster County, a place that he hoped would be much more hospitable to his faith than Switzerland. About 100 years later, in 1812, Hans's great-grandson, Christian, made another migration, this time a much shorter one, to Cumberland County. So there we have the lineage, okay? The martyr, her great-grandson, and now the immigrant's great-grandson, Christian, whose gravestone I showed you a few minutes ago. Christian made a migration to Cumberland County, where he settled on this farm about 2 miles from here. It's likely that Christian Hess, this great-great-great-grandson of the martyr Anna Hess, helped to build the 1816 church building that we're commemorating today. Now, you know there are Hesses in our congregation today. I mean, there's probably lots of Hesses in here today, but many of us would know Lyndon Hess and Lionel Hess and Rosalie Rowland, who was a Hess before she was a Rowland. And of course, this is their family's story. But as Mennonites, it's also our story. Story of spiritual ancestors who faced real hardship and because of their faith sought out a place where they could raise their children without the fear of losing them. It's not surprising, and Paul alluded to this a little earlier. In fact, I think it should be the case that many Mennonites over the years have had a heart for people who are facing hardships in other parts of the world. People who are looking for new homes to raise their families in peace. So one of the questions that we might ask this morning as we think about our spiritual forefathers and foremothers is, how has Slate Hill done in that regard? How have we welcomed strangers who may be coming from other parts of the world where they just need to leave? It's hard to assign a grade, though I would say that our Lao Fellowship is one indication of that sensibility in this congregation that lasted into the 20th and 21st century. And you'll hear more about the Lao Fellowship this afternoon. We also took a collection up a couple weeks ago for new Syrian refugees, people that are leaving Syria and entering the United States. And I think that only an absent-minded Mennonite congregation would forget that early Mennonites were driven from parts of the world that they loved, just like refugees are today. So when we hear about refugees and immigrants today, we should always, I think, try to imagine that they are us, because we were indeed once them. So that's my first story, martyrs and migrants. My second story is titled this, When Sunday School Was Bad. Now, if we could travel back in time and walk into our 1816 church building, we might wonder why they didn't build a real church. This simple brick structure looked something like this, and I found this on the internet. I think it's about what it looked like. It was basically one relatively small rectangular room filled with backless benches and a pine table in the middle where the ministers stood. And this is a little model that Paul and Nancy Knisley have put together, and I think it's somewhere here today, right? Out in the lobby that you can look at. The minister's table sat on the same level as the benches, unlike our pulpit, which was no accident. It was important for everyone to see that the ministers, spiritually speaking, were on the same level as everyone else, something we don't see, for instance, in this non-Mennonite church. I think it's an Episcopal church, where the preacher hovers somewhere between heaven and earth. Okay? So you see him up there. There he is. The idea of ministers being on the same spiritual level as everyone else has a long history in the Anabaptist Mennonite tradition. In the midst of persecution, you never knew when your group's minister was going to be hauled away in the middle of the night. And so you needed to be ready if you were called upon to be the next minister. Anabaptist women didn't assume that formal role, but compared to other churches in the 16th century, Anabaptist churches gave a lot of latitude to women to testify and to preach, and some of them did, even as they were being marched off to their executions. Here's another image from Martyr's Mirror. It's a picture of Macon Wentz's two sons looking through her ashes the day after their mother was burned at the stake. As the story goes, these two sons found the tongue screw that clamped Macon's tongue, which was the most common way to silence Anabaptists who wanted to preach their faith, which apparently Macon had been doing and would have liked to have done on the way to her execution. Let's return to our 1816 church building. Though let's not call it a building. Let's call it a gemeinschaft. That's what the Pennsylvania Dutch spiritual ancestors of this church called it. Not a kirche, a church, and not even a versammlunghaus, which is meeting house, but gemeinschaft, or gemeinhaus. This term means community house, and it made it clear that this building was not sacred in and of itself, but was only a means to give shelter to the community of people who gathered there. Before 1816, the congregation had met in homes, but in 1816, there were enough people gathering together that they needed a slightly larger gemeinschaft, a community house, and so they built it. As the congregation gathered in 1816, it used a hymnal that was published by Lancaster County Mennonites in 1804. Up until then, Lancaster County Mennonites had been using a hymnal called the Ausbund, which was compiled by Anabaptists in the 1500s. And the Old Order Amish still use that hymnal today. They still use the Ausbund. But by 1804, Lancaster Mennonites wanted something that felt a little bit more relevant to their situation. So they published a book called the Impartisches Gesangbuch, or Impartial Songbook. Impartial, that's a funny adjective. Impartial Songbook, because it included songs from many different religious and Christian traditions. If you're interested, this is a copy of that 1804 hymnal. There's a number of them downstairs in a box. One of the two up here is David Martin's copy. David Martin was the man who donated the land where our church building was built. So we still have that Unpartisches Gesangbuch that David Martin would have sung out of. Like the Ausbund, the hymns in the Impartial Songbook were written in German. But unlike the Ausbund, some of the hymns included musical notes in them. The Ausbund did not. Pennsylvania Mennonites weren't quite ready to sing in four-part harmony. That wouldn't start until the late 1800s. But with the publication of their Impartial Songbook in 1804, it was clear that these Lancaster County Mennonites were becoming more open to the larger world, and especially the larger Christian world. But they weren't yet worldly enough to have Sunday schools. And Paul, again, alluded to that a little bit earlier. If we take another look at the 1816 layout, you'll see that there's no dedicated places for Sunday school classes to meet. And for the first 50 years of Slate Hill's existence as a congregation on this site, there were no Sunday school classes being held. In fact, until 1871, the Lancaster Mennonite Conference, the conference that Slate Hill was a part of, and which we're still a part of, until 1871, they actually prohibited Sunday school from taking place in any of their congregation. Now, that seems strange to us, but it's really not an accident. I said that earlier, Anabaptist tradition operated on the assumption that the ministers were on the same spiritual level as others in the congregation. But that assumption, when pressed too far, made at least some Mennonite bishops anxious. What would happen, they thought, if we opened the doors to spiritual instruction that went beyond the bounds of the preaching on Sunday morning? What would be taught? What would our young people hear? Can any old Joe or any old Ruth, or I might add, any old Trang or any old Jeff, or any old Ron or any old Rhoda, what would happen if they would teach Sunday school? Wouldn't it be better if we kept a tighter rein on things and avoided that kind of dangerous practice? For whatever reason, and we don't know exactly why, the Lancaster Mennonite Conference decided in 1871 that congregations could start Sunday schools as long as the membership in that congregation was unanimous in wanting to do so. Now again, that strikes me as a strange stipulation, that one person could veto what everyone else might want to do. But in 1872, Slate Hill became one of the first Lancaster Conference churches, Lancaster Mennonite churches, to start a Sunday school. Apparently, everyone was on board with the idea, or at least those that weren't on board with the idea were content to keep their mouths shut. So what should we make of our congregation's past on this score? This afternoon, we'll hear more about the role of women in this congregation and how Slate Hill was generally ahead of other Lancaster Mennonite Conference churches in giving women roles in congregational leadership. So at least on these two issues, and again, you'll hear more about women in ministry this afternoon, on these two issues, Sunday school, women in ministry, Slate Hill found itself on the more progressive end of things. Perhaps that's because we were way out here in the West, out in Cumberland County, 50 miles from the heartland of Lancaster County Mennonites. Maybe that frontier mentality allowed us to travel new frontiers in Sunday school and women in ministry. In any case, most of us here are glad that we traveled those frontiers, making Slate Hill what it is today. A place where many people, both women and men, can speak and teach and discern God's will together. Now my third story. Did you hear that? It's the sound of Noah Mack rolling over in his grave. And that grave is not out here. It's a lot farther away. So who was Noah Mack? Noah Mack was born in 1861. As a young man, he was a school teacher in Lancaster County. In 1900, Mack was placed in the lot to become a minister at the Groffdale Mennonite Church near New Holland. Now, this wasn't a new thing. Noah Mack had been in the lot before. That is, he had been nominated to be a minister, but the lot had never fallen on him, which I think most of you know means he had never selected the right book, something like this book, among the various books before him that had a slip of paper in it that said, Noah, you're the minister. So he had been in the lot before, but had never picked the book that contained the slip of paper. This time around, again in 1900, this time around, something strange, you might even call it miraculous, happened. According to John Ruth's History of the Lancaster Mennonite Conference, Mack fell into a trance that, according to his own testimony, made the covers of the book transparent. In other words, Mack could see through the book's covers and see the slip of paper that sat in one of the books. And he selected that one. There were probably some men that would have avoided that one. But Mack, I think, wanted to be a minister. He selected that book, and instantly he became a minister for the rest of his life. Now, I have no way of confirming whether that actually happened, but for the rest of Mack's life, he claimed that it did. And before long, he had become one of the most influential ministers in Lancaster Conference, was particularly effective as a revivalist, holding some of these protracted meetings that Paul Knisely talked about earlier. For our purposes, Mack is significant because in 1926, he was appointed as bishop in charge of the Lancaster Mennonite Conference district that contained Slate Hill. Mack's appointment was made in response to some unrest in Adams County, where there had been no bishop and no bishop influence for decades. According to John Roos' History of Lancaster County Mennonites, the biggest problem in Adams County was a prosperous family of fruit processors with a last name you know well, the Musselmans. These Musselmans were boundary pushers with respect to Lancaster Conference rules, especially with respect to plain dress, which they didn't like, and life insurance, which they did like, and which they bought. The Musselmans were every bit as headstrong as Bishop Mack, and they were not intimidated by their bishop. This is how John Ruth puts it in his history. Noah Mack felt that he could handle his friend C.H. Musselman, who he had known in the Groffdale area. In return, the Musselmans felt that they could handle Noah Mack. So, I don't know who ultimately handled whom, but it wasn't just Adams County Musselmans who bothered Noah Mack. It was also the Slate Hill congregation in Cumberland County. According to Joe Hess's History of Our Congregation, Mack, who never allowed anyone to take a photograph of him, kind of like the Amish today would never allow that, nearly had a conniption one Sunday morning when he arrived at Slate Hill. That's because he found Florence Strong, Florence Detweiler, who we know, taking a photograph of her Sunday school class outside our church building. And apparently on his way home from Slate Hill, which he'd visit occasionally, back to Groffdale, where he still lived, he would stop at a fellow minister's house to discuss church affairs. And according to that minister's daughter, Mack would sit on the couch, sigh deeply, and then launch into a lament about the progressive nature of the Slate Hill congregation. We don't know all his concerns, but dress was likely at the center, the 1920s, 1930s. Here's a picture of the Slate Hill youth from 1925. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the women are appropriately attired. But just look at those boys. The ties, the sports coats, the stylish haircuts, they look like they're going to a frat party. Now, if I'm reading the picture correctly, and some people can correct me if I'm wrong, I doubt these young men are church members. But when they became members, they likely, or at least many of them, would have put on plain coats with no neckties. They might have looked like Chris Zimmerman looks today. Do you want to stand up, Chris? Okay, you know, they might have looked more like that. Chris, I approve of that outfit. But the plain dress vanished over time, even among members, until the only thing that was left was the women's prayer veiling. This, of course, was the last thing to go, at least almost gone, because 1 Corinthians 11 is so very clear that God is offended by women who cut their hair and refuse to cover their heads. Or let me rephrase that. The prayer veiling was the last thing to go because Lancaster County Mennonites had always believed that 1 Corinthians 11 was clear that God was offended when women cut their hair and refused to cover their heads. So where did all the head coverings go? There's still a lot in 1976. Where did they all go? Well, some went into dresser drawers, into storage closets. Did anybody put theirs in a wastebasket? I'm not sure. But others went to Churchtown Mennonite Church, which is a church that many of you know near Boiling Springs. They went there happily riding atop the heads of women who, even to this day, read 1 Corinthians 11 the way we used to and the way Noah Mack wanted us to. So did you hear that? It's the sound of Noah rolling over in his grave. So, on mornings when we celebrate our congregation's past, it's easy to settle on words like fidelity and faithfulness. I think it's also important to note that Christians, even ones in this little slice of Christianity we call Mennonites, don't always see eye to eye. In fact, some of our differences never get fully resolved this side of eternity. A few years ago, I spent a Sunday at the Churchtown Mennonite Church. I felt a little bit like an alien from outer space, not a visitor from a Mennonite church that until the 1960s was in the same Mennonite conference as Slate Hill. But as I looked around that sanctuary at people in plain dress, men on the one side, women on the other side of the sanctuary, as I sang hymns from a hymnal that I had never seen before, it reminded me that many people who are trying to be faithful to God end up at a very different place from me. And though I'm not sure I like that, it's probably good that not every Christian in this world looks and thinks like me, or even looks and thinks like us. So, finally, story number four. Standing here where others have stood. Now, this picture has nothing to do with what I'm going to really talk about, except they are standing here where others have stood. That's Paul Zimmerman. And that, Lee Rowland, who is that? That is Lee Rowland. Right there. Paul Zimmerman's not quite sure he's approving of what's going on. Although maybe he is. And Ben Myers, somewhat bemused. So standing here, these people were standing here, and we're standing here where others have stood. As I was preparing this talk and reading some books about Cumberland County history and about Pennsylvania history, it struck me that the history of this place that we call Slate Hill has a much longer history than our congregation's history. In fact, much, much longer. About 12,000 years before David Martin bought this land, Native Americans, Algonquins, found their way to this part of Pennsylvania. Like Jeremy Stoltzfus and like many others of you, they would have spent a lot of time near water, including the same stream that today we call the Yellow Breeches. They called it the Calipatsink, which means where the waters turn back, which you would know well if you've ever tried to canoe or kayak or tube down the Yellow Breaches. It just takes a long time. The Algonquins were eventually replaced by the Susquehannocks and then by the Shawnee, who were building villages here about the time, 1681, they're building villages here about the time that William Penn was giving proprietorship of Pennsylvania. The largest Shawnee village was about 4 miles from here in New Cumberland. Okay? There you see Bridge Street. It's probably right there where the Yellow Breaches spills into the Susquehanna River. Next slide. It looks a little like this today. So when you drive over that bridge in New Cumberland, you can imagine this is where the Shawnee had their village centuries ago. Even nearer by, the Shawnee had a burial ground on a hill not unlike this one, though as one historian notes in a very understated way, the hill no longer exists due to a quarry operation. By the 1720s, Scotch-Irish settlers were making their way into this area. And in contrast to what you might think when you see this sort of painting from the 19th century, and there's a lot of paintings done in the 19th century, no treaties had yet been made with Native Americans when these Scotch-Irish settlers were settling, which means these English-speaking settlers were squatting on lands for which they had no title. The Pennsylvania government wasn't happy about this, but it did little, and the squatters eventually gained title to the land, or at least stayed on it for a long, long time. Land that was eventually sold and ended up in the hands of first-generation Mennonites, Slate Hill's first members. These members, our spiritual ancestors, put that land to good use. The hills between the Yellow Breaches and the Conedogwinet were good for farming, at least some of the areas were, and Pennsylvania German Mennonites were good farmers, much better farmers than the people from whom they bought the land. David Martin was one of the first Mennonites who purchased land, 433 acres in 1810, land that he farmed. And in 1816, he decided to give one or two of those 433 acres, to his Mennonite church family so that they could build a gemay house and establish a cemetery. And the rest, as they say, is history. The little gemay house was replaced by a larger one in 1876. It was expanded again in 1949, and again in 1977, and then again in 2005. The Zimmermans and the Hesses and the Martins were replaced, or not replaced, they were joined by people with non-German sounding names, and German language hymnals were replaced by English hymnals, and eventually by PowerPoint slides that are beamed from the ceiling. What used to be a gemay house full of plain-dressing farmers became a modern church building filled with people from a variety of occupations and professions. And what used to be a church of men and women run by the men has become a church of men and women run by all of us who live out the gospel the best we can. And when I say live out the gospel as best we can, I'm not saying that we've scaled to a height of faithfulness that's never been seen before on earth. I mean something much more modest. We live at this place, at this moment in time, unable to see the world from any other vantage point. And from this vantage point, we do the best we can as a congregation. And the same can be said for our spiritual ancestors, who lived out the gospel the best they could. From all indications, they were very dedicated, very diligent, and very serious-minded in their approach to the Christian faith. But like us, they were also flawed. They took the Bible very seriously, so seriously that up until the 1950s, the ministers greeted one another with a holy kiss, not unlike what I found on this slide. Again, that's not from our church, but it represents the way things were done. The ministers greeted each other that way, not because they liked it, but because the Apostle Paul commanded it in four of his New Testament letters. But if Joe Hess's history of our congregation can be trusted, most of them refused to extend that greeting to James Lark, an African-American Mennonite minister who preached at Slate Hill in 1948. Apparently, the New Testament command about the holy kiss was to be taken literally. But then Lark showed up and complicated things, because it's one thing to kiss your brother from Lancaster County, quite another to kiss your black brother from Chicago. Now, I tell this part of our story not to denigrate the reputations of our spiritual ancestors, who we have every reason to believe took their commitments to Christ seriously. In fact, if there's one thing to be learned from looking at our congregation's history, it would be this. Faithful living requires a serious-minded commitment to Christ and a willingness to live and give sacrificially. At the same time, taking an honest look at our ancestors reveals the limits of their spiritual vision, limits that meant falling short of the glory of God no matter how hard they tried. And that part of their example is also important, for it suggests to us and reminds us that our vision, like theirs, is limited. Indeed, it's quite likely that in 2116, our spiritual descendants will look back and wonder how we could have done some of the things that we did. Maybe. Now, knowing that our spiritual vision is limited is not, I hope, a reason to throw up our hands and say nothing we do matters, nothing we think matters. Rather, it's a reminder that God's faithfulness far exceeds our own. That our congregation could make it to 200 years is testimony not to our abilities, but to God's willingness to use ordinary, flawed people to do his work on earth. People like David Martin, people like Christian Hess, people like you, people like me. So I'll conclude this talk with a verse from 1 Corinthians that I would guess has been read hundreds and hundreds of times over the last 200 years. And that verse is this. Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Amen. Well, thank you for coming today.